At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Amateur Traveler, episode 558. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about ancient palaces and crusader castles, primitive man, ancient villages, and garbage dumps, as we talk about the UNESCO World Heritage Sites of Israel and Palestine. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Without further ado, let's talk about special things like World Heritage Sites. I'd like to welcome back to the show Gary Arndt from everything-everywhere.com, who has come to talk to us again about UNESCO World Heritage Sites, this time in Israel. Gary, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I'm now in the 10-timers club, so I think I get right. A robe and a key to the clubhouse.
That is quite possible, yes. This is the 10th time that Gary has been on the show. For those of you who are scoring at home, we've done shows on the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in the United States and the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Canada, travel to St. Helena, to the Leeward Islands in the Lesser Antilles in a two-part series, to the microstates of Europe, to the Canary Islands, the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in general, the Gulf States, and to Micronesia. So, Gary, you and I were both just in Israel, and you went to the rest of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites you had not been to.
Yeah, so I had previously been to Israel in 2009, and while I was there, I visited probably the more popular World Heritage Sites. Mm-hmm. We were both there for a conference recently, and I took the time to visit kind of the remaining ones that I hadn't visited before, as well as the two World Heritage Sites in the West Bank.
What order should we do these in? Should we do this, lay this out as an itinerary? How would you tackle them?
So there are 9 in Israel, technically. Mm-hmm. 2 in Palestine, and then there's an asterisk. And that asterisk is Jerusalem, the old city, because technically, if you go to the official UNESCO site, Jerusalem is not listed under any country. When it was initially submitted, it was actually submitted by Jordan, not by Israel, because of the disputed status of Jerusalem. Hmm. So that's going to be the one I think most people probably go to would be Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem. So technically, it's neither Israel nor Palestine, but it's an obvious one that needs to be mentioned.
Excellent. Well, why don't we start there?
Sure. We were both just there. Not only were we both there, but you actually went on a photo walk with me. And I think we hit what are probably the 3 highlights of the old city, which would be the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, mm-hmm. the Western Wall, and the Dome of the Rock, which are the 3 major holy places to the 3 major religions in Jerusalem. But there's a lot more to the city, obviously. There, and I think people obviously go there thinking of the Bible, in particular the New Testament or the Old Testament period.
Sure.
And there is so little of the city which actually goes back to that time, because it's been continually inhabited for thousands of years. When you're walking around, say, the walls of the city, what you're really walking around today are walls built by the Ottomans.
Right.
If people go expecting, you know, oh, I'm going to walk on the very same stones that Jesus walked on, no, you're not, because that's all been replaced and built up. So you might be walking kind of in the same vicinity or in the same area, but you're probably not going to be touching, you know, the same things.
Well, there are some places where there you can still see the old Roman paving stones, but just a few places. There's one place just in one of the side alleys on the way to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre from the Jaffa Gate. And there's also the Roman cardo, the old Roman marketplace, which they have uncovered at least a little part of, which used to run the width of the city. But yeah, other than that, it certainly is a city that has changed a lot and continues to change. And one of the things that I didn't realize when we were there, I missed going on the thing that I want to do next time, which is the archaeological dig of the City of David, which is actually south of the old city. So the oldest part of the old city is outside the old city, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. The thing, if you've never been to Jerusalem, what I thought when I was there for the first time is how small the old city was.
Right.
It's not huge. And these things that you may have heard references to in the Bible, or there are certain things such as Mount of Olives, Mount mm-hmm. Zion. We would really today, I think, call it the Hill of Olives or the Hill of Zion or things like that, because they weren't really that big. And another good example, if you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, mm-hmm. that was built on, there was a cave there. And they basically carved away everything to get to the inside of the cave, which is where they thought Jesus laid down. And one of the interesting things I noticed in visiting all these other World Heritage sites, there are a lot of caves in this area.
Sure.
Like mm-hmm. a lot of caves. I was visiting one of the sites in Palestine, Batir, and the guy was telling me that he was doing some renovation on his basement and they found a cave. It kind of puts it all in into perspective when you're kind of there and you're like, oh, like, or if you go up to Galilee and you kind of get a perspective for how big it actually is.
Right. The old city is only 1 square kilometer, I think is what I remember hearing, which is pretty darn small.
Yeah. So that's the first of the World Heritage sites.
Well, and we should mention, because you have mentioned on numerous occasions, including the keynote at this TBEC conference we were at, that your favorite city in the world, and your favorite building in the world, your favorite city is Jerusalem, your favorite building is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yeah, I find that building fascinating.
I find it fascinating. I wouldn't say it was my favorite. It's terribly dysfunctional.
Yes, and that's what makes it my favorite. So we're recording this in 2017. Mm-hmm. They're doing major renovations inside the church right now. So it's probably...
They actually just finished some of the big renovations in time for the day after the conference ended. They took down the scaffolding around the spot where the tomb was.
Oh, well, shows my luck.
But you missed it by 2 days or something like that.
When I was there in 2009, that little building that's under the dome was completely black mm-hmm. from candles. And they had, in fact, a box of sand that surrounded it that people would go and put candles in. And I think they got rid of that, so it'll stay cleaner in the future. But yeah, it definitely looks a lot better.
Yeah, it's interesting. One thing I would recommend for there is we did a tour. You talked about the photo tour. We did it very early in the day. And I did find that I was there 3 times total. Once because I went with Joan when she came a couple days later. And we went later on in the afternoon, and it's a zoo. It's just a complete zoo. And yet when we went early in the morning, you and I, and then I went even earlier still the first day that I was there, and that worked out to be much nicer because a lot less people, a lot less crowds to contend with. I actually happened to be there when they were doing a service, and it was a very, very different place when it was filled with music, with chanting, with organ, and those sort of things, than seeing it with just crowds of tourist groups.
Yeah, my first time I was there, I actually went on Easter morning.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Really interesting experience, yeah. The Western Easter is usually a week off of the Eastern Orthodox. Mm-hmm. So Western Easter will usually be there Palm Sunday. And in fact, we're recording this a day before Easter right now. So they have different services going on, and then they kind of have their schedule. And I'll just say this, if you do visit, just when you before you walk through the door, look up and check out the ladder, because it's a fascinating story behind it that I think is in a microcosm really explains how dysfunctional the building is.
Did you want to tell the story about the ladder and the status quo?
Look it up on Wikipedia, because it's just so interesting. And I'll just say this much. There's no symbolism behind the ladder, really. I mean, maybe there is now. It's been there so long. But yeah, it's just a ladder, and it's been there 150 years.
I feel like that begs a question, but we'll move on here. But look up status quo is going to be the key word in terms of how that church is managed by a great variety of different denominations. Anything else we want to say about the old city of Jerusalem? Actually, the other thing I would say that is not part of the whole old city is a UNESCO part?
Yeah.
I would say that when we were there, we both stayed near there. In fact, I stayed at the Tower David Hotel, and you stayed, I think, at the old King David Hotel. Both were wonderful hotels, very near the Jaffa Gate, and an easy way to get to the old city. But I really enjoyed the Tower of David that I toured, both in terms of having a great view of the city, and then if you don't know the history of the city, there's a really very wonderful layout within the Tower of David Museum in terms of the history of especially the old city of Jerusalem and all the many, many, many people who have come in and conquered it.
Yeah, I think we could do a whole show on the old city of Jerusalem, but
we will move on.
Yeah. You know, the next closest one, and we might as well talk about the ones in the West Bank, because they're really close to Jerusalem, would be the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem.
Right.
And I don't know if you got a chance to go there.
Not on this trip, unfortunately.
It's under heavy renovation right now, but it should be finished by the end of this year. It is a very old church. So the building itself dates back to the year 500-something. And it's in that very old basilica style.
Mm-hmm. So it's Byzantine.
Yeah. If you've ever seen photos or sketches, you wouldn't have seen a photo. Sketches of what the old St. Peter's Basilica looked like before the current version.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar in a way to, if you go to Rome, St. Paul's outside the wall, where you have this kind of central area with two wings and columns. It's like that. And there's a weird history, like you have to enter through this tiny little door. And the explanation we're given is that they basically made this door so tiny so people wouldn't bring horses inside.
Okay.
There are some beautiful mosaics and artwork inside. We had a hard time seeing a lot of it because of the scaffolding.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend getting there as early as possible because there's a long line of people. And I also recommend getting on a tour that actually goes to see a bit more. Because the way it used to be, the tours would walk down Star Street, which was kind of the path supposedly they...
The wise men walked down, I'm guessing here?
Yeah, or Mary and Joseph.
Okay.
Then there's also the Milk Grotto, which is also not that far away. But a lot of tour groups, they come, stop at the church, and then leave. Mm-hmm. And that's all they do. So there are some other interesting things in the area. The Manger Square area, you will often see reports from Christmas about crowds there. The interesting thing, we were told by our guide, almost all the crowds during Christmas are local.
Oh, interesting.
They're Palestinian. And Bethlehem, even I think it was 15 years ago, the population of Bethlehem was 2/3 Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And today it's just under 20% Christian. And the reason is because so many of the Palestinian Christians have left.
Mm-hmm.
They've moved to other places. They moved to Europe, the United States, and Latin America. The only thing you need to know, it's really not hard to get there, but you are technically leaving Israel. So many places in Jerusalem will provide tours there that will pick you up. And usually you will be picked up on a bus with an Arab driver because people with Israeli passports are not allowed to go. The way the West Bank works, it's kind of confusing. There's A, B, C, and C zones. The A zones tend to be the cities, and they're totally controlled by the Palestinian Authority. The B zones are kind of controlled by Palestinian Authority in Israel. And the C zones tend to be the open areas, the rural areas where nobody lives, and the Israelis control that. So this is going into an A zone. So you're going to probably pick up a guide once you get into Bethlehem who will then join you, which is what happened with us. You will need a passport, not that you will necessarily be checked. So I went into the West Bank twice, and neither time was I checked for a passport, but it might happen. So you have to bring it, because if they do check, you might not be allowed into or out of, or back into Israel if you come back.
Okay.
The second one, which is not far away, it's a bit more difficult to get to, is the village of Battir, B-A-T-T-I-R.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more recent addition. It was added to the World Heritage List in 2014, and you will not find a whole lot of visitors going there. I really had to go to my way. I had to get a taxi from Bethlehem to get there. It wasn't horribly expensive. There were some roads closed, which made it a little bit more difficult for me. But basically, it's simply terraces like you might see in Bali or you might see in the Philippines, but not nearly as grand and majestic. They're rather small. And you know, if I had to rank all the World Heritage sites I've been to, this would probably not be high on the list, to be honest. But yeah, Bethlehem and Battir are the two that are currently in Palestinian territory.
Okay.
So the other one, so we have Jerusalem, which is the exception, and then the Palestinian ones. Now we can talk about the Israeli ones. And we might as well talk about some of the more popular ones first that most people would go to if you're on a trip to Israel. And the most popular one is probably Masada.
Right, right.
So Masada, if you're not familiar with it, if you didn't see the miniseries that came out, I don't know how long ago that was.
Or the movie with Peter O'Toole, which is quite old.
Yeah. Back when the Romans were cracking down, the Masada was actually the palace of King Herod. It's located near the Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm. Herod the Great.
And this was kind of the last stand where a bunch of the Jewish rebels
The Zealots.
Held out. The Romans lay siege to it. And after, I think it took over a year, they built a ramp. And on the day that they knew that they were going to storm the gates, everyone killed themselves because they didn't want to be put into slavery. It's a rather interesting temple. One of the interesting things about it is that the square of the Roman encampment where the Romans stayed and the ramp they built to rush in, it's still there because that area around the Dead Sea gets so little precipitation. Everything is right. Really well preserved. It's a big tourist spot. A lot of people doing bar mitzvahs there. It's a popular place for it. There and the West Wall are popular places. But it's also, if you go out there, a great opportunity to go see other stuff kind of in the Dead Sea area as well.
And I thought Masada was definitely striking and absolutely, absolutely would be one of the top places on my list, the ones that we got to. Now, you said that you can see the square of the Roman encampment. I think you can see five different squares of different Roman encampments and the siege wall still, as well as the siege ramp. So, yeah, amazing. And it was quite an elaborate palace, or actually two palaces, that Herod built here on the top of this mesa. And if it would just had that, it would still be worth seeing. If there was no amazing, interesting, tragic story about Masada, but it's the combination of the two. And you can walk to the top, or you can do what we did and take the gondola. So either way, there's a way to get up that is adventurous or a way that's easy.
I just should also add, it's very easy to get tours from Jerusalem to go to Masada. Pretty much any hotel will offer that, and it's a very easy day trip.
Well, we should also say, so we rented a car and we just drove around. We did not drive into places like Bethlehem. That's not some place that is really, you could take an Israel rental car. But even though from Masada, we went from the Galilee area through the West Bank on one of the highways, which is allowed and easy and simple to get down to Masada and very easy to drive in Israel. I would avoid driving more in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. It's just, you know, big city. But I didn't think the traffic even was as bad as some of the Israelis seem to think it was, but.
Well, that route between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv is horrible. And then north of Tel Aviv on some of the highways is also really bad as well. That the traffic is
just bad as in slow. Yeah.
Yeah. So the next one would be the White City of Tel Aviv, which I have to say, and I've been there twice. I've been there twice for the express purpose of visiting this World Heritage Site.
Mm-hmm.
Is arguably not only one of the most disappointing World Heritage Site in Israel, but one of the most disappointing in the world. It has to do with modernist or international style architecture, which is usually considered kind of the Bauhaus movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find frustrating is that there are so few good examples of this, that you walk along the city streets and supposedly there are a fair number of buildings which fall into this World Heritage Site, but most of them are not in very good shape.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk down the road and you look at this apartment building and that's a World Heritage Site and the one next to it isn't. And you're like, well, what's the difference? It's just an apartment building. Why should this be placed on a list along with the pyramids and the Colosseum of Rome? And yeah, they need to do something, I think, better with it, create a more unified walking tour or something. There's a couple buildings that I think are good examples of it. The biggest one being the Hotel Cinema, which is a former cinema turned into a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, yeah, I found it really disappointing. And like I said, I've tried twice. My last one, I did a guide who has been guiding in Israel for like 30 years. Didn't find it great.
Well, we spent two nights in Tel Aviv, and I think we walked past some of these, and I didn't even notice them. And so I'm not even counting it as a place that I've been to. There is a Tel Aviv Bauhaus Museum there, too. That might be one of the best places to get more information about that. But if you want to do Bauhaus, honestly, I would say Dessau in Germany is probably a better place to see that.
Correct. I was in Weimar as well, where the actual Bauhaus school was.
In Weimar, yeah. Well, it was both. It moved from Weimar when it was kicked out because of things got more conservative.
The actual World Heritage Site in Germany covers both spots.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So the next one will go up to Haifa and the Baha'i holy places in Haifa and Western Galilee. And basically the main site for this is Baha'i Gardens in Haifa, which I think is the shrine of the Bab. And it's a beautiful garden. You absolutely cannot miss it. It's right in the middle of Haifa on the main hill. I think it's called the German Village, is the area immediately below the gardens. And whether you go in the day or whether you go at night, it's one of the best kept and maintained gardens I've seen anywhere in the world.
It's quite spectacular. And when you say the main hill, that's Mount Carmel.
Yeah. Speaking of which, another World Heritage Site, not far from Haifa, is the Sites of Human Evolution at Mount Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those sites that a lot of people, I don't think, they don't visit. It's a very small part of the national park system in Israel. I was there when a group of paleontology students from the University of Haifa were there, so I got to listen to their presentations. And basically why this is important, there are four caves. These are naturally occurring caves on the side of Mount Carmel that have human ancestral remains dating back several hundred thousand years. So it is a very long time of history. And they've excavated one of these caves down extremely deep, and they found a lot of stuff. It is the southernmost point that they have ever found remains of Neanderthal bones.
Oh,
and it's one of the only places in the world where they have found remains of Neanderthal and early humans in the exact same spot occupied during the same time period.
Hmm.
So they probably met, you know, at some point along there. Visiting paleontology sites and some archaeological sites can be very difficult to visit because the reason why they were deemed important was dug up and put in a museum.
Right. Sure.
So in some places, there's just nothing there.
Right.
But they do a very good job in terms of interpretation because at least you have caves you can look at. And inside one of the caves, they'll have some figures. And it's the kind of place where a lot of school groups go.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's very easy to get to. You can do by car. And it is maybe 20 miles from Haifa, if even. So very easy to get to. Next would be the old city of Acre or Acre, depending on how you pronounce it. My Israeli guy pronounced it Acre. And that is basically...
It's Acre or Akko. A-K-K-O is the way it's spelled.
But it's basically an old Crusader town.
Mm-hmm.
Buildings date back from the Crusade. There's a museum there and some other places, but a lot of the city, it's just currently being inhabited.
Mm-hmm.
People live there, and it tends to have a large Arab population, like some of the other cities in the north do. Again, not far from Haifa. You could easily get there. If you want to visit a lot of World Heritage Sites, Haifa is a great place to do a whole bunch of them on day trips because you're literally within 1 hour and get to like five of them, I think, within that space.
Before you go past that, we didn't really say much about this. It's an old Crusader castle, basically Crusader city, walled city. And the last place that the Crusaders had taken, last place that fell to the reinvading, in this case, it would be the Mamluks that came in and reconquered the Holy Land. But I thought it was fascinating because it was amazing how well preserved the hospitaller portion of the city was, because apparently at one point they had come in and just buried the whole thing in dirt and built their palace on top. When that palace eventually fell down and they started doing excavation in just recent years in modern times, they discovered whole halls where the hospitaller knights, who were somewhat rivals to the Templars, would have their meals or things like that. And I was just surprised how much of it was intact, considering that it had been conquered and quite large.
Yeah, it's a very interesting spot. And like I said, an easy day trip if you're in Haifa.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is a serial site. And I think you've been to one of these. It's the Biblical Tells, and there are three of them.
Right.
Megiddo, Hazor, and Beersheba. And I actually got to go to all three of them.
Oh, okay.
The one that gets the most visitors is Megiddo, basically because it's Armageddon. That's Megiddo. That's what it is.
And we say that is Armageddon. The Greek name for this place is Armageddon, where the Bible says the last battle in all time will happen. And apparently quite a few battles have happened over time because this is on the crossroads at the kind of the top of the Fertile Crescent. So a lot of people coming and going at, for 10,000 years in this particular area. Lots of places built on this spot here in Tel Megiddo. Yeah, a fascinating place.
So I got to visit Megiddo with a woman who had been digging there for the last 20 years. So she knew this place inside and out. And it was very interesting how the word Megiddo became Armageddon. In Aramaic, I guess, when something ends in a vowel in Hebrew, they tend to put an N after it. So Megiddo becomes Megiddon. Mm-hmm. And then the word for hill is Ha Megiddon. And then kind of just got bastardized into English by Armageddon. That's how it became. But anyways, a tell, so it's called the biblical tells. And a tell is basically the Hebrew word for mound. And these mounds are basically like a layer cake.
Oh, yeah.
As you go back, they just built on top of these things. And I think Megiddo has like 20 different layers. And the interesting thing is that as they kept building up on top of the old stuff, that hill becomes smaller. So mm-hmm. the last thing on this hill, it was actually a cemetery for Roman centurions.
Hmm.
And the Romans were actually encamped near the hill, but they buried people on top of it. In the early 20th century, there was a group from the University of Chicago that came through, and they really dug it up.
Mm-hmm.
The excavations you see at Megiddo are far more extensive than what you're going to see at the other two places. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really dug a lot of trenches to the point where you can't even see the initial height of the tell. There's a lot of stuff that if archaeologists were doing this today, they would have done it very, very differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one place where they made a particularly dramatic cut, and you could see the different layers of the cake, as it were. You could see, I think it was 7,000 years of different cities being built on top of one another, and you could, they had got signs that would lay out and say, okay, this is the temple that was in this area, and down here, that's from a different, you know, as you went down the hill, it would kept being an older and older and older civilization.
The people that were doing the initial excavations, they very much wanted to tie everything they could to the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And they especially wanted to tie things to the time of Solomon, which not everything necessarily was.
Yeah.
may have come a little sooner, a little afterwards. But you'll see things like, you know, this is Solomon's Gate. Not necessarily. These names were given out of a desire, I think, to sensationalize it a little bit. Hazor, to put this on a map, Megiddo is not too far from Haifa. It's kind of at the very tip of the West Bank area, the northernmost part. Hazor is north of the Sea of Galilee, pretty close to the Golan Heights, does not get very many tourists at all. It was, in its heyday, much bigger than Megiddo. And I should also add, the reason why these three places were selected to go on the World Heritage List, and there are other tells that are very similar, has to do with the water system. So I don't know in Megiddo if you went actually down.
Yeah, into the cistern.
It's huge.
And hand-carved. Yeah.
Yes. Hand carved,
crazy,
really, really deep, like really deep. Like you're surprised. And they did this by hand back in the day, no artificial light. And so not only did they dig deep, but then there's a tunnel
in rock too. We should say that it's all solid rock.
All this multi-layer cake we're talking about, there's a tunnel that goes horizontally through it. And this was done so that they could get water in the event of a siege.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also a lot of travelers going near it. So they were able to bring water to the outside of the gate so they could do so safely, so travelers could have water without necessarily bringing them inside the city walls.
Hmm.
Hazor and Beersheba have very similar water systems, very large, very elaborate water systems. And that's why these three placed there. And Hazor and Beersheba are also mentioned in the Bible as well.
When you said a lot of people don't get up to Hazor, in fact, I suggested to Joan, my wife, who was traveling with me for 6 days after the conference, hey, we're not that far when we're up here in the northern edge of Galilee, up in Capernaum, from this other UNESCO World Heritage Site. Should we go up here? And it was just a little too close to Syria for her. Just, I'm sure it would be completely safe right now, or, you know, as safe as Israel is, which is, I'd say it's a good time generally to go, although there have been a few things that have happened since we went there. But it was still just too close. She looked at a map. It's like, I don't think I want to go to the Golan Heights. And this is just a little bit to the west of the Golan Heights.
Yeah, I had absolutely no problem there. And the reason why it gets so few visitors is simply because it's north of most of the things on the Jesus Trail.
Right, right.
Edo is between, it's a stopping point for people that want to go to the bathroom between
on the way to Nazareth, Galilee, yeah,
and Jerusalem. So that's why it's so popular. Hazor is bigger, but it doesn't seem like it because there hasn't been as much excavation. Mm-hmm. Or it hasn't been nearly as destructive. There's a palace there, and the palace is actually mentioned in the Bible. And I forget what prophet it was that destroyed it, and there was a big fire. And they actually found evidence of a very high-temperature fire which cracked some stone inside one of the buildings. And the other is Beersheba, which is the name of the modern-day city, which is nearby. When you're there, you can actually see the city. It's not that far away. But there, too, it also does not get very many visitors. But it has the same elaborate water system, probably not quite as interesting because you'll see some outlines of some ruined buildings on the surface, and that's about it. Megiddo's probably the most interesting of the three and also the most visited.
Okay.
The other, in we're kind of closing up the Haifa area and in the north here, is the necropolis of Bet Sharim. And this is very interesting, and it's probably only of interest to Jewish people. That tends to be most of the visitors. And what it is a bunch of tombs which date back to about the 3rd century AD.
Mm-hmm.
And they're Jewish tombs. And they've only excavated some of them. After the creation of the State of Israel, there was a rabbinical ban on exploring some of the other ones. So they haven't been checked. And they estimate there's maybe several hundred of them. But there was a very famous rabbi at the time who they believe was buried there. And this was basically at that time period where it was as close as people could get to Jerusalem to be buried, which is why it was so popular and why so many Jews were buried here. And many Jews were buried there who were not from that area. So they may have come from Damascus or Cyprus or places like that. And their bodies were then brought there to be interred. The tombs have a lot of Greek on it, Roman and Byzantine styles on some of the sarcophaguses.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you know that they're Jewish is because they have the menorah,
okay,
which is the symbol that was used for a lot of ancient Jewish things. So if you go to the catacombs in Rome, which I've also was able to do, not a World Heritage Site, but very interesting, you'll see some of the same insignia on the walls there.
Mm, interesting. When we should say this is one of the five you mentioned as being easy day trip from Haifa.
Yes. To kind of summarize what they were the old city of Acre, Baha'i holy places, the human evolution sites of Mount Carmel, Bet Sharim, and Tel Megiddo.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all very easy day trip. It's probably less, maybe Megiddo's like a 45-minute drive from Haifa, and that's the longest one.
Mm-hmm.
Then going south, we got two more. One of the most interesting ones is Bet Guvrin and the caves of Marshara.
Mm-hmm.
And this might be one of the most fascinating ones in all of Israel. A couple things make it interesting. There is an ongoing archaeological dig in the area. This is an area that has some very soft stone. And what happened 2,000 years ago is that people would dig this stone and they would dig holes into the ground to get bricks for building houses and other structures. And as they kept excavating this, they had larger and larger holes underneath their homes that were basically kind of like a basement, if you will. And as they kept digging, these got very, very large, and they were eventually used for grain storage, water storage. They were used as cisterns.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, they were used as garbage dumps. And so what's happening there, and I met a guy again, he was running the archaeological dig. This is one of the few places in Israel where you, as a civilian, can actually go and participate in an archaeological dig.
Hmm.
And archaeological dig there is entirely funded by these private efforts of people going there and digging. And the reason why they open it to the public, because in a lot of places, they're very concerned about the order and the stratigraphy of how things were located.
What strata they found different things, because that helps you date them, sure.
Here, they're not concerned about it because it's a garbage dump.
Hmm.
And everything was just kind of put together. So they're basically just kind of bringing stuff out in bulk. And so there's tons of pottery, and the pottery may be Persian pottery, Egyptian pottery, Greek pottery. shards of it all together. They have animal bones, and they, you know, they test all the animal bones for what type of animal it is. Mm-hmm. And they found an abnormally large percentage of chicken bones. And someone wrote a paper on that. If you want to go to Israel and have that kind of experience, this is a great place to do it. And this is about a 45-minute drive from Jerusalem going south. So it's very easy to visit. The biggest distinguishing thing have to be the big caves. So the area is sectioned into four, A, B, C, and D. And in section D, these caves are really big, like really, really big. Like you could have a pickup game of baseball in one of these. Like they're shockingly large. Like
wow, okay.
You're amazed that one, that humans could have done it, let alone humans 2,000 years ago. Hmm. And, you know, there's birds living in it, and it's quite remarkable. And then there's also a Roman area nearby that has an amphitheater, I should say theater, not an amphitheater, as well as some other buildings that are easily accessible. There's like a small gas station near there, and the entrance is like in the parking lot of the gas station. Again, this is a place where a lot of school groups go, mm-hmm. but I would add it to your list if you're going to be going to Jerusalem, just because it's so fascinating. And then the last one, which is in the south, is the incense route, the desert cities of the Negev. And there's several of these cities in Israel, and they constitute part of what I would say is a series of three different sites, one of which starts in Oman, which is the frankincense route, mm-hmm. which is where a lot of that incense was created. It then goes to Petra, which was part of the Nabataean trade route.
The Nabataean.
Yeah. And it came into Israel, and then the final stop was in the city of Gaza. And it was there simply because that was the closest point to the sea.
Sure.
For the trade route. And then from there, they would go to Rome, Cyprus, Constantinople, wherever. There's four towns. I went to Avat and Shifta, which are both part of the national park system. Again, very easy to visit, off the road. Pretty much all of the World Heritage Sites in Israel are very easy to visit. Mm-hmm. This is no exception. These cities were also in use well into the Byzantine and the Crusader periods as well. So you will see Christian churches in these places, as well as older abandoned buildings dating back to pre-Christian times.
Now, you mentioned this being a national park. A number of the ones that we have talked about are national parks, and you can get a national park passport. You can also do what we did. If you're going to be there for about 6 days, we got a 6-park pack that let us get into 6 different national parks, some of which are World Heritage Sites, some are not. Some of the World Heritage Sites are not national parks, but it still helped us get into a number of places, including Tel Megiddo, for instance, was one of the ones that we went to that was both. And then we went to some other parks that were not, like Caesarea or Capernaum. And some other national parks, some Crusader castles and the baptism site of Jesus. Some of the national parks that are really small are actually free entrance, but it did help us in terms of at least 6 of them. Basically, we used our 6-pack. So that's something to think about if you're doing a road trip to getting all these. And generally, when we're talking about this, you rented a car to get down to some of these sites, for instance.
I had a guide with me. So I worked with the Israel Ministry of Tourism. And they had a guide, and he did all the driving and took care of everything.
Okay. Well, for those people who don't get a guide from the Ministry of Tourism, generally we're talking about a road trip here.
Yeah. We never had to go off-road, for example, anything. Everything's on a paved road. It was all very simple. And we even went to some sites which are on the tentative list.
Oh, interesting.
That may become UNESCO sites in the future.
Because you don't want to have to come back after they become UNESCO sites, huh?
Well, I'm not interested in just those things. For example, in Mitzpeh Ramon in the Negev Desert, mm-hmm. the Maktesh. And what was great is that the guy we had talked to us there, who's a geologist, just went nuts when he learned that I had studied geology, because I knew what he was talking about. And he was just so excited that he gave me a demonstration and was, you know, showing me all these mineral samples and stuff. And the next day, he's like, hey, let's show up early. And they took me out. And the Maktesh is basically, it's called the crater. The Ramon crater, but it's not a crater. So it's not an impact crater from something coming. It's basically the earth splitting and then erosion cleaning it out.
Now, is this on the Rift Valley that includes the Dead Sea?
It's very close to it.
Okay.
It's actually not part of it. It's its own thing. But it's a unique geological formation. There's not a lot of them in the world, but it's kind of like going into, I'd say it's like going into the Grand Canyon, but not quite. Hmm. I mean, it's not as big as that. But that was one. We went to the first kibbutz ever, which is located right where the Jordan River meets the Sea of Galilee, right at the south end of that.
Oh, okay, sure.
Which is kind of interesting. Caesarea, which I think you also visited, is on the tentative list, although I don't know if that'll ever make it, to be honest, just because there's so much development around there. And the area is so developed itself. There's so many shops and everything.
Well, it's interesting. It's the strangest national park, or one of the strangest ones I've been to, because there are three different gates, I think, going in. And if you go into one, you're just in the historic part. But if you go into one of the other ones, which is where we went into first, it's all shops among the ruins. And you could get a ticket that got you into just, I think it's just the shops. And then basically people were treating that more like a park, a lot of kids running around and things like that. And then it wasn't until you went into the rest of the ruins where the theater was and the Hippodrome and some of the other spots that there were less crowds. It was an interesting spot, an interesting site. One part of it is quite developed in terms of shops and ice cream stores and souvenirs and things. It was a different approach.
Yeah, which is why I don't know if it'll ever actually be put on the World Heritage List. They're very fussy about preservation and having buffer zones around it. And I don't know if you noticed, there's a big electrical generating plant right nearby as well.
Oh, sure. It's hard to miss it.
Israel's, I think, only golf course is right there as well. So there's a whole lot of stuff that is really kind of right at the very edge of it. So I don't know if that would happen. But, you know, there's so much. People go there for the Holy Land attractions, but there's just so much there going back further and since 2,000 years ago to see. So that's why I thought like the Mount Carmel caves really takes history back hundreds of thousands of years, that people were coming down this area that really connects Europe and Africa and Asia kind of in this spot, which is why you had so much happening there.
Well, and that's the other thing I thought that was fascinating about Tel Megiddo too, is that really was a connecting spot, very much almost the connecting spot. If you look at the map and look at the geography between Egypt and the Euphrates, that, you know, basically so much traffic was going through this otherwise what looked like a nice valley, but not that significant until you really look at where it fits into the Fertile Crescent.
Yeah, going back to that, the archaeologist that was with us in Megiddo, her theory was that when Megiddo was referenced in the Bible, the largest Roman encampment outside of Jerusalem in that area was in Megiddo. Hmm. So that was kind of used as a code word for the Romans. So when they talked about, you know, a battle taking place there, what they really were talking about was a revolt against the Romans.
I could see that. Okay.
That's what they said. So
interesting. As we go to wrap this up, Gary, which one of these places that you went to surprised you? It over-delivered on what you expected.
Bet Gruvrin. I felt that the place with the caves, there's a lot there. And the size of it kind of surprised me. I was really kind of shocked at how large some of the caves were. And then also its approach to, you know, letting people take part in an archaeological dig, which I thought was great. If I go back, I wouldn't mind doing that for a day. I think that'd be kind of fun and something you could say you did.
And then I think your vote for skip it, if you had to skip one of these, sounded like it was the Tel Aviv and the White City.
Yeah. You know, if you're in Tel Aviv, you're just kind of there. So it's not something you have to go to your way to either see or avoid. Like I said, I went there once. I went there again. Both times, it just was not that impressed.
I enjoyed the seashore of Tel Aviv, and we walked down to Jaffa, which, you know, has some significant biblical history there in terms of where Peter was at the house of Simon the Tanner, and there's a house there that's still labeled that. But, you know, I don't know that I would say you have to get to Tel Aviv necessarily to see Israel, although it's a great way to see modern Israel. It's definitely a significant thing in terms of understanding what Israel really is, not what Israel was 2,000 years ago.
Well, I should say, this is not I'm not making a statement about the city of Tel Aviv.
Sure. No, I understood. Yeah.
I'm just saying that about these buildings in Tel Aviv, I just wasn't that impressed with.
Well, and part of the things, as you know, somebody who thought they were going to be an architect at one point, part of the thing that I thought was interesting when I did see the sites in Germany that we'd referenced that were Bauhaus wasn't the fact that the architecture was stunning. It's that the architecture was ahead of its time. But for those of us who are now almost getting to be 100 years past that time, when you just see the buildings, it's like, okay, it's an interesting building, but it isn't, I don't know. It can be a little disappointing if you don't know the historic significance, I think.
Yeah, and there's another one in Germany as well, the modernistic housing estates in Berlin, which are still continually used. They're basically apartment buildings.
Right, sure.
You get off one of the U-train stops and you look around, and that's really all there is to see. And some of them are in better shape than others, but that's it.
Anything else before we get to our wrap-up questions?
I think that when people visit Israel, there's kind of a set route people take.
Mm-hmm.
I would say about half of these sites are not on that typical route.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's worthwhile to go out of your way maybe to see them if you can. If you're going there for religious reasons, they're not necessarily associated with the life of Jesus, but they're associated with the history of the Holy Land.
Sure.
Before and after the time of Christ. And I think it's definitely makes your trip a little bit better.
And I looked at all of these sites when we were trying to figure out where we were going to go. We obviously didn't go to all of them, but then we also got, as I mentioned, the National Park Pass. And I found that that was another great way of discovering sites that we would have driven right by, because why is this a national park and what's this all about and such? And it made us look things up and it made us say, oh, well, that sounds kind of interesting. Oh, there's a Crusader castle, you know, overlooking the Jordan River. Let's go up there. So those sort of things. And I like that sort of way. And I think that's what I find the UNESCO World Heritage Site list useful for, is that it tells me about things that I might not have noticed.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been to 327 sites now.
I think I'm a 119, so.
By doing that, it's taking me to places that I otherwise would never have visited.
Absolutely.
There's a couple obvious ones, Great Wall of China, Grand Canyon, things like that, that everyone goes to. But there's 1,052 World Heritage Sites now, and it's going to take you and show you aspects of history and culture that you probably didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of these sites do not get a lot of traffic. They do not get a lot of visitors. Some of them should, but you're going to explore a lot more by just going out of your way to see them, I think.
Excellent. Which of these is the prettiest?
Oh, the Gardens of Haifa, the Baha'i Garden.
I think that is a defensible position. I thought, although it's a very stark beauty, I thought Masada was also just very striking. We're talking about a very arid area.
Certainly the view from there of the Dead Sea is quite nice.
One thing that makes you laugh as you're on your UNESCO World Heritage Site tour of Israel.
Something that makes me laugh.
You usually say one thing that makes you laugh and say only in Israel, but in this case, it would be only in Israel, only in a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Well, I don't know if it'll make me laugh, but shockingly enough, all of these sites are open on Saturday.
Oh, uh-huh.
If you're in Jerusalem, everything shuts down for Shabbat on Saturday, but all of these national park sites are actually open on Saturday. So something to keep in mind.
That actually reminds me, though, the one thing we did run into an issue with, because we were there in March and the schedule changed in April so that they were open for an hour longer. But what we found at some places were the site closes at 4 p.m. and they won't let in people at a lot of the national parks after 3 p.m. or it closes at 5 and you can't get in after 4. So we were limited in terms of how many we could do in a day just by the hours being limited. So if you're doing some of these sites, getting up early and getting to them as soon as possible works better than doing it late afternoon because you just may not be able to get in. Tel Megiddo, we kind of ran through because we had 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour. I don't remember exactly, but it wasn't a lot of time because we were just running out of time in the day.
Yeah, and I'd also add, if you're visiting these, I don't really think you need more than an hour at most of these,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of the Old City of Jerusalem.
Yeah, sure.
It may be the, you know, the Crusader town up in Acre, but
yeah,
the rest of these, I think an hour is plenty of time. And I had experts with me who had spent years there, and those visits lasted maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they could have talked longer if they wanted to, but none of these sites are huge and require a whole lot of time walking around.
Even the Old City, I would say one day and you can really see a lot of the Old City. You won't see everything, obviously. There are layers upon layers, but I think one day can give you a really good overview. Two would be fine. Two would be better. You could find things to do with three. You'd start adding in some of the other things like the City of David or, you know, like some of the more modern things like the Jerusalem Museum and see the Dead Sea Scrolls. But yeah, one day, even in the Old City, I went on a 2-3 hour Sandman tour of the Old City, and it was a great overview in terms of having an idea of what you were seeing and what some of the key spots were.
I am always a big fan, if you can do it, of getting a guide.
Yeah.
Anywhere you go, just because they're going to be able to point stuff out and explain things that, you know, just having a book or even an audio tour, you know, something on your iPhone isn't going to be able to do.
I agreed. Excellent. I'm going to thank Gary for coming on the show and coming back on the show so many times and sharing with us his wonderful travels and his love for Israel and the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in general. Gary, where can people read more about your travels?
They go to everything-everywhere.com. I have down in the footer links to all my UNESCO World Heritage Sites that I've visited, and from there you can see the write-ups for every single one.
Excellent. Gary, thanks again. I would like to remind you that if you're interested in seeing World Heritage Sites, some of them, like the Taj Mahal, will be included in the Amateur Traveler trip to India that you can find out more information about on the show notes. That trip is November of 2017. If it's past 2017 or India is not your scene, then join the group amateurtraveler.com/trips, which is a private Facebook group to talk about where we should go next. In news of the community, I often share the good reviews and the nice things that people say about Amateur Traveler. I had a negative review on Amateur Traveler on iTunes recently. It says, "I could not take it any longer. I have been a subscriber for years, but finally cut the cord as I could not take the host anymore. I subscribe to about 30 podcasts, and I feel I know when a host is doing a good job. I find the host condescending and righteous. It is not obvious, and I'm sure the host will disagree, but I can't tell you how many times the host will correct the guest on some fact. That in itself is okay when done well, but it comes across as all-knowing, just poorly done. And enough with the same four questions at the end. It has run its course. Inevitably, it's always about the same answer, just packaged differently. I really tried to hang on since some of the places are unique and wonderful, but I need to move on. I will stick to the Rick Steves podcast for my travel." Well, I'm sorry I turned you off with my condescending attitude. I can come across as a know-it-all. It's true. I won't disagree with that. I don't mean to, but I'm afraid it's probably true. And Rick Steves does have good podcasts, so that is certainly something that if you are tired of the Amateur Traveler and my condescending know-it-all attitude, I can highly recommend that one. If you disagree, you might want to leave your thoughts as an iTunes review instead. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or go to amateurtraveler.com/iTunes to leave a review. And thanks so much for listening.